So tonight's topic, following on from last week, is called "We Are All Sick." So I don't know if you may feel that yet, but we're certainly sick of it all sometimes, aren't we? And we get sick of things, and in a way, recognizing ourselves as sick is a really beneficial attitude. So we'll see why as we go through the course tonight. So each of our classes are a standalone topic. So even if you just come in for tonight, it's going to be okay. They do go in a kind of order, but it is fine to just drop in whenever you can. And as usual, when you've got questions, just wave your arm around. I like questions and comments. So last week we talked about what a Buddhist refuge is, what seeking refuge is, that urge for kind of safety and guidance and protection, and the ultimate checklist of the qualities of a refuge. And then our kind of our goals, how far we can aspire, or do we unconsciously put limits on ourselves, on our goals, on our potential. So it was a lot that we covered. Was there anything that stood out to you during the week that came up or that percolated to the top out of all of that, stuck in your mind? Ta-da, to be happy and to be useful. I know, it's mind-blowing, isn't it? That the question, what is the meaning of life, which we all do wonder and then try to find different ways to answer that. And we can go spectacularly wrong sometimes, and end up quite nihilistic. But yeah, that one, it's incredible. So it sounds simple, but it's really hard to do, to be happy and to be useful, because it means that we act. And so that's pretty much what the whole rest of the course is about, how to act and how to make those decisions. Yeah. Yes. And what about our default refuge? Throughout the week, did you notice what you were taking refuge in? Yeah, there's a smile over there. Tell me. Just collapsing on the couch. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Doing nothing, which is actually, trying to create some space and calm and rest, all of those things. So it is doing something, it's just that it's not economically viable at the time. The reasons for taking refuge, that's right. So the reasons really are reflected by those goals of how we, what are we seeking refuge from? And part of that is it's a really big question. And that's, again, what we'll look at tonight to start clarifying that more. So that's good that it's becoming clear. Yeah, really excellent. Okay, so what we'll have a look at tonight, we'll do this and then do a short motivation. Yes, there are benefits recognizing ourselves as being sick. And one of the benefits is that it switches it from feeling that we ourselves are bad or that there's something wrong with us. Because when we get sick, we don't go, "Oh no, I'm such a terrible person. I got the flu or I got a migraine or something." We don't judge ourselves when we're sick. It's not minimizing the problem or the suffering, but it's a different way of looking at it. Yet there is a whole lot of self-blame that goes on all the time in our minds. And so recognizing ourselves as sick rather than bad or rather than broken gives us a way to work with things. It's a very useful attitude. There's huge advantages to having this attitude. So I will say that a few years ago when Venerable Robina came and was giving talks, she had a talk about called "We Are All Sick." But actually, I think her talk was titled "We Are All Sick." But when she started, she said, "Well, actually, we're all junkies." And that did not go down well. There's like this intake of breath from half of the audience, like, "No way, I'm not one of those." But she did go on to show how we are. We're junkies to samsara, to distraction, to desire, to dissatisfaction. And it drives everything, and it's a junkie mentality. So actually recognizing, just like in AA, when you recognize, yes, I'm an alcoholic, or yes, I'm a junkie, that's the beginning of healing. Because while you're in denial, there's no way. There's, but yeah, it was we can only become happier, more peaceful once we actually admit that we're not in control of our life. That just like with sickness, it comes over us and we can't do anything about it at the time. We're also going to have a look at the big picture, the Four Noble Truths. So you may have heard about the Four Noble Truths, and in a way, this is like a worldview that sees reality really clearly. It's a very big worldview, and we can take it as a working hypothesis. So it's not something that we need to believe in, but it's something that we can use. And then we're going to have a look at how to be a clean cup or a clean vessel so that we can retain the teachings and they can help us and we don't contaminate the teachings. Because there is a lot of kind of baggage that we bring along with us that we're not aware of. And also, just through life's ups and downs, we can end up corrupting our good intentions. And we start off really virtuous and altruistic and end up cranky. It's like, what happened? What happened along the way? Why didn't it work? So it's a way of how to avoid kind of rookie mistakes. So let's set our motivation for tonight. And first, we can adjust our posture, then we can adjust our mind. So adjusting our posture is a nice balance between having a fairly straight spine and feeling that your posture is alert. So feel that your lower back is supported, but put a little bit of effort into keeping your spine fairly straight. Imagine a thread of light running from the base of your spine up through your body and coming out the crown of your head, as if it's being gently pulled upwards. Then your posture will naturally align. So you might notice that you just sit back a little bit, open the chest and heart area, pull the shoulders back. Have your head just slightly tilted forward. Relax all the muscles of the face. Feel the stability of your seat. And bring your focus gently, bring it inwards to be anchored on the breath. Just the simple rising and falling of the breath, breathing in and breathing out. And let all the thoughts of the day just come to rest, like autumn leaves come to rest once the wind has stopped. We can, as any thoughts or memories or feelings arise, just notice them and let them go. If they're important, we can pick them up later. And then we can adjust our motivation as well. So we can start where we are with our purpose for coming tonight. There must have been something that got us here. And then taking that as our starting point, expanding our motivation so that it becomes really vast and altruistic. That we can be here to develop all of our own qualities and potential. that we can bring the greatest benefit for ourselves and everyone around us, everyone that we make contact with, and that the benefit can be not just a temporary benefit, but an ultimate lasting benefit. And having the courage to entertain the thought, what if I became a Buddha and could perfectly, effortlessly help all sentient beings out of suffering? How amazing that would be, and let our intentions stretch out to that kind of vision. And so then we can get started on our main topic. So if we're all sick and sick of it all, what are the things we're sick of? Just randomly.
Crazy pace of life.
Crazy pace of life. Addiction to stress. Yes.
Having to listen to war.
Having to listen to war all the time, let alone be in a war all the time, I just think, oh my gosh, how would I cope if I was born on the other side of the world? What else are we sick of?
Their own life.
People not taking responsibility for their own lives. I'm also sick of washing up. I've managed to just wash up on Mondays and then I stretch it out a bit further, and now I'm contemplating just paper plates. Honestly, there are other things I suppose that we're sick of, but it's more that we're terrified of them as well. I mean, we're living in frightening times. And then there are the things that we can't bear, like our own, if we get sick, or our own emotional turmoil when it's, when it's bad, it's unbearable. So the Buddha's teachings are about alleviating suffering. So they're not about when did time begin, or what was the beginning of the universe, or why this or why that. It's a really simple kind of thing, which is we're human, we suffer. Can we end this suffering? And because that's what the Buddha's teachings are about, we take the Buddha's teachings as a personal instruction. So it's not just academic. It's not just a nice idea or something that sounds amazing, but it's something to be used to actually apply. And part of how we apply it is developing this special attitude, viewing oneself as sick instead of a bad person. And so some of us are obviously sick. If we've got some kind of mental illness or distress, we've got some kind of diagnosis, all the acronyms and the ADHDs and the dyslexia and autism and alcoholism and all of the things, they're more obvious. And in a way, having these labels can be really helpful because already then we become open to help. Whereas if we go around going, nah, I'm fine, it's everybody else that's the problem, we've really shut the door to anything changing. There is also, I've noticed, a real humility that comes when you recognize that you're sick, or the day when I recognize, oh my God, I'm one of those people. And I stop being the good person. I'm like, I'm one of those ones. And it's like the whole world turned around, and it was deeply shocking. But I think that was the beginning of my whole inner journey when that happened. And it's quite a leveler. There's a bit of humility that comes in, and also immediately you recognize there are other people in the same boat. So there are many expressions of the sickness, some just more obvious than others, but it's an underlying problem that manifests differently. And just because someone seems that they're all together and fine doesn't mean that they're not suffering. And so the sickness, what the actual sickness is, the disturbing emotions. So we have I've found all the emojis. We've got just fear, which comes from grasping at an inherent self or grasping at an idea of ourselves that's just fundamentally mistaken. And so that grasping causes fear and anxiety and horror. And we don't even know that we're doing it, but we know we are if we recognize that we're fearful. Then that's the cause of it. Just general hatred and anger. So we have this grasping at who we are, and then when it comes up against something that we don't like, disagree with, conflict, then we get angry, we get frustrated, we lash out. We've got the underlying craving and dissatisfaction that's there all the time, that it's never enough. Whatever we have, we want more. Or we want the next one. We've got just kind of doubt, sadness, and envy, jealousy. So when somebody else is happy, instead of being happy for them, it's like it rubs our nose in it. So there's nothing like virtue to set people off. Real resentment, like how very dare they? Virtue or generosity. So all of these are called disturbing emotions or afflictive states of mind. And so that's what the disease is. When we're afflicted, we suffer. And disease, a state of unease, again, it's much more a cause and effect thing than a judgment. It's not that we're bad, and it's actually not that there are any bad people. But it's people with afflictive emotions, with afflictions, acting under the influence. So it's quite a different worldview. And, of course, when we are acting under all of the influence of these things, what kind of person are we? Sick, unhappy, mean, inconsistent, irrational, make the worst decisions. And in a way, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves because if we are undergoing all of these afflictive states of mind, and then we expect so much of ourselves, it's not very compassionate either. So this is from a book, The Buddha's Medicine for the Mind, by the Australian Geshe Thachi Tsering. The desire for happiness is common to us all. Everyone wants to be happy, but various circumstances prevent this. Why do we encounter frustration and unhappiness instead of the deep and lasting happiness we seek? Could there be a cause, or do happiness and unhappiness just occur randomly? Unhappiness is like a side effect of an illness. If the illness is properly diagnosed and treated, the side effects disappear. Recognizing this, the Buddha diagnosed the illnesses that lead to unhappiness and prescribed a cure for them. And the Dharma, the Buddha's teachings, are the Buddha's medicine for the mind. The Buddha knew from experience that unhappiness is a product of disturbing emotions. These emotions have a negative influence on our state of mind and cause us to act negatively. The Buddha realized that if we could uproot disturbing emotions, we would uproot the causes of unhappiness and plant the seeds for true happiness. So remember how we were talking about a Buddhist is an inner being. What this means is that as long as we do not recognize we are sick, we will blame external circumstances for our suffering. And if we do that, then we'll never become free. So I saw this just the other day that we had a teaching, and there was a lady here who something was going on, and I couldn't figure out what it was. Anyway, afterwards she said, "I'm never going back to that place." I'm like, what happened? So what happened, she had a really bad back. And she was sitting on a chair over here, and because there was quite a few people, there were a couple of people sitting on the couch. And normally we have this couch for people if they've broken their leg or they've got a bad back and can't, or sciatica or something like that. And so she sat there, but she didn't tell anybody. And so then she just thought, everybody's so rude. No one gave me the couch. I'm never going back. I'm like, oh no. So how can you How can you get that so wrong? So, number one, you get it so wrong because you're already suffering. So, you're not working at your best and you are irrational. And then forget to ask for help because when we're suffering, we're kind of fighting against it, aren't we? We're going, no. We're trying to grin and bear it, grit our teeth and bear it. And so, it doesn't occur to us, I need help. But the main thing is, I'm suffering because of everybody else. That's the real trap. So that is a bit of a refuge. It's like a short-term refuge of this settling into resentment that we have. It's other people. They did this and that hurt me and I'm cranky and it's their fault. So the whole time that we're saying it's their fault, we're getting off scot-free, but also what's happening, we cannot do anything about it. We remain trapped. It's like it's a total tragedy. So the urge to blame, it's really deep-seated. And I personally think, I don't know if I'll ever uproot that urge to blame, but what we've got to do is point it in the right direction and stop blaming other people. So often what happens, then you go on a spiritual path and you go, oh, it's not other people, it's me. And again, we point the blame in the wrong place because it's not which, what me are we talking about when we're pointing here? The physical me? But it's usually the seeker, the searcher, the sincere one, or the vulnerable one. When we say me, we don't say it's my afflictive emotions or it's my arrogance. We go, it's me, and we're just being mean to ourselves. So these extremes that we go through, it's everybody else's fault. No, it's my fault. No. The fault lies in the afflictive emotions, and that's really where we can point the finger. So before any study session or meditation or even just sitting down with a nice cup of tea, staring into space, trying to figure out what the heck is going on, think, I'm a student seeking a cure for my own unrest. And then imagine that all of the wisdom and the instructions that we get and the Buddhist methods are like a cooling balm for the mind. You can even imagine it as nectar, like that pacifies our feverish mind. And of course, the end point is eventually, when we can heal ourselves, just like the Buddha did, then we can help others. So, one of the ways that we can really recognize that human beings, actually all living beings, are sick rather than bad, is just to think of kids at a birthday party. So there's a level, isn't it, where enough sugar is consumed that those children start turning into like poltergeist style devils, right? And all the adults go and hide. But you know deep down they're not the devil, and you know they're not bad and they're not wrong, and you know that they've got no control. They're under the sway of the disturbing emotions, and everything's just come together. And what can we do? We may have to isolate them, but there's not the judgment there that they're bad. There's a real understanding. So grown-ups are like that too. It's just not as obvious. And not only that, but also like you look in the natural world, snakes and whatever, they can't help it. They're under the control of the form that they're in. So I find with children and with animals, we can kind of forgive them because we know they can't help it. But with adults, we think they can help it. But actually, most of the time, adults can't either because the control of the afflictions is so strong. And we just mask it. And so a lot of hatred and impatience comes from that, and it's just a misunderstanding. So, comments, questions? There are limits to our patience and compassion. Yeah, so it takes the pressure off your own mind, doesn't it, just to understand that. And then also when we reach our own limit of compassion or patience, we don't have to feel guilty or anything like that, and we don't have to change our mind and flip right into, well, no, actually they're bad after all. We just know we've reached our limit and we need to take a step back for a moment while still recognizing their suffering and care about them. So it actually makes it easier for us to calibrate our own emotions and response. Because most of the time when we are caring about others and we reach our limit, we feel so bad about having to step back that we push and push and push. And the only way that we can is to flip our mind and go, no, they're bad after all. And then the only thing that gives us the impetus to leave is anger. And we don't want it to get to that. So we're going to touch a little bit more on the different types of suffering tonight, because there's a lot more than just the obvious suffering. And I found that really useful, to how to recognize the different levels, layers of suffering. Yeah, and again, like all that, the term of being a doormat, I mean, there is the intention to benefit, but it's not being realistic about your own limitations. So then we go extreme again. And instead of going, I have a limitation, I have to step back and still caring about them, we just go, well, I can't care about them.
And
so then turmoil, more inner turmoil, So all the methods of how to negotiate this, how to continue to be kind and compassionate and also be realistic. Okay, let's do a short reflection then on how to incorporate this attitude. So settling your posture, feel your breath easing. And imagine that you notice the first signs that you might be coming down with something like the flu, some kind of illness, inviting awareness rather than worry. And remember that understanding our disturbing emotions, it's like catching an illness early. There's the benefit in noticing sooner rather than later. So bring to mind a wish that this reflection may help you and in turn support the well-being of others. Today's point is simple. It's that disturbing emotions like ignorance, desire, and hatred arise in all of us, shaping how we see and act. And when they go unrecognized, they spread through our thoughts, much like an undiagnosed flu moving through the body. So this is why recognizing we're undergoing a sickness is helpful. Disturbing emotions are often contagious, passing within ourselves from one reaction to the next and escalating from one person to the next, unless we intervene. What happens when we ignore confusion? It multiplies, much like a virus taking hold when we don't rest. And how can we work skillfully with desire, desirous attachment? By noticing its symptoms early, as we would a rising temperature. And what helps us respond to anger wisely? Recognizing the anger before it actually is expressed, before it peaks. As we would try to treat a flu before it becomes severe and we become cranky. So let this understanding encourage you to observe your mind the way you would monitor your health, gently, consistently, without judgment. And make a determination to strengthen your health with the vitamins of virtue, the fitness of your own ethics. To enjoy rest while rejoicing in your efforts. We can conclude this reflection with the awareness itself, which is a powerful form of medicine. So take a nice breath in, bring your focus back to the room. And let's have a look now at the Four Noble Truths, and in particular about suffering, the nature of suffering. So the Four Noble Truths are, I mean, that's what they kind of translated as, but what it means is the truth seen by noble ones, or the reality that is seen by the noble ones, the Aryas. And it's because the way that we see reality is very superficial. We believe the appearances. We really succumb to appearances. And then we kind of have a resistance to reality, and then that causes stress. So the first of the noble truth, the true suffering, is to be able to recognize suffering, what it is. And there are actually three types of suffering experience. And normally when we talk about suffering, what we're talking about or what we think of is obvious suffering. So when we're sick, when we're miserable, when we're sad, when we have emotional turmoil, when problems are happening, it's really obvious suffering. Obvious physical pain, emotional turmoil. But that's just one layer. There is another type of suffering, which His Holiness calls the suffering we run towards. And that's where we seek refuge in things that don't last. So we find a refuge, we find some solace, but it doesn't last, so we're devastated. We take refuge in our family, in our cats, in our friends, and it works for a while, but it doesn't last because friendships end. And that's devastating. And cats die. So it's not a reliable refuge. We take refuge in our career, in our house, and we know the problems that come along with both of those. So it's in a way a suffering that we run towards because the expectations that we have is that the happiness will last, the security will last, the help will help us. And it can't, but it's actually our expectation of this that brings the suffering. I remember one relationship that I had where I knew it wouldn't last because the person was leaving. And it was a really good relationship. Why? Because the expectations weren't there. They're only going to be here for another 3 months and off they go. It was so non-complicated. There were a whole lot of things that I just didn't worry about. Like, don't sweat the small stuff and appreciate what's there. It just made it really easy. Then there's the third type of suffering, which we can understand as like the pain of day-to-day existence. The fact that because we have a body, we're going to suffer. It's going to age. It's going to get hurt. It's going to get sick. That's its nature. And because we have emotions and because our mind is unruly, we're going to suffer. It's like we're a walking wound. And we don't kind of know until we bump up against it. Then it's, ow. So it's actually the nature of our existence, this samsaric existence. So the day-to-day suffering, the all-pervasive compounded suffering, where we're like a magnet to problems. So this is something that all living beings experience, but it's not obvious. Because until, especially when we're in a privileged kind of society like this, we can think we're okay. Until something goes wrong, and then even that, it's belied in our speech, isn't it? As if something's gone wrong. No, it's just that realities appeared to us and we find a limitation or we get sick or we get hurt. And then we think something's gone wrong, but actually our whole nature is wrong like that. The all-pervasive suffering is there, but it's not manifest all the time. And then it's a shock when it manifests. So actually, the whole Buddhist path is about dealing with that, becoming free from that type of suffering, not the ordinary, obvious suffering. In fact, the ordinary, obvious suffering we can use because it means that we become more compassionate. We develop empathy. We understand others. We really see them. So it can be really beneficial, whereas this much more subtle or pervasive suffering, that's the one we're seeking freedom from, and that's what the Buddhist teachings seek to help us with. That's actually the main thing. And I think sometimes we have an insight into life being in the nature of suffering. If you've ever been suicidal, this kind of thought is that it's all suffering. But with our suicidal thoughts, we don't take it to the next step, which is there something that we can do about it? We kind of just succumb to the feeling. So I remember in my teens being suicidal and thinking there's no reason for living and everything's gone wrong and it's just all terrible. And I had this blinding insight that the whole lot was suffering. But luckily, I'm a quite ponderous person, so I was keeping a journal at the time, so I just started asking questions. And so I was like, yep, okay, there's no reason for living. And so then it's like, well, ergo, there's no reason for dying. Like, got to be consistent here. My reasoning dug me out of the hole, and so I couldn't find any good reason for dying either. So then I was like, okay, I'm going to stick around. See what happens. So when you're suicidal and people say, oh, it's not that bad, it is that bad, and there is a real insight there, but that's only the first bit. And we've got to have the help or the impetus to keep asking and go through that to the next bit, which is, okay, what's the cause of it? What is the cause of my angst, of my suffering? And suffering, it's not random, it's a result. Anything that we experience is necessarily a result. So we have to find the cause of it. And just thinking that it's everybody and everything else doesn't stand up to reason. We've got to get a correct diagnosis of the situation. And there is a huge relief in being able to name the illness. And if we name the illness that it's my own afflictive emotions, immediately we have a relief. Even if the cause is out there, is other people, is situations, what we find is that those things are actually a trigger. Because if our own mind wasn't disturbed to start with, we wouldn't be disturbed by those situations. And you can have the same situation and everybody responds differently. Why is that? Because we're all being triggered in different ways. And some people are triggered that it brings out all their best qualities rather than suffering. So that's called true origin, to correctly identify the causes of suffering. And that's hard because they're not immediately obvious. Then the next one, yes, ending suffering is possible. put it in colloquial terms, wellness is possible. A state of optimal flourishing is possible. And all living beings have this potential. So this is called true cessations, that the cessation of suffering is a possibility. And that's radically different from our Western worldview, which is to kind of just, you know, it's as good as it gets kind of thing. You just learn to live with it. It's a very short-term kind of view. It's really radical to think I could eradicate the afflictive emotions from my mind forever. I could eradicate anger. I could eradicate jealousy. And if those, you know, and craving, and if those afflictive states of mind are eradicated, there is nothing to cause agitation and disturbance in my mind. The result is peace. So in the West, we often say, oh, yeah, but anger is natural, or, you know, jealousy is natural. So just because it's natural doesn't mean that it's permanent. It doesn't mean that we can't do anything about it. Pain is natural, but doesn't mean that we have to just be passive about it and not do anything about it. Understanding that ending suffering is possible means that then we have to understand the nature of our mind. Otherwise, we don't get it. And so that's where the method, there is a method to get there. It's not that it's only Buddhas that can end suffering and ordinary people can't, or that only one bunch of people can and the others can't, or only humans can and nobody else can. It's that there is a method to bring about the cessation of suffering. And there are actually many approaches for many dispositions. So the Buddha taught many different approaches, and we touched on that last week with our different goals. And it's kind of like having different levels of fitness or stages of realization. So exactly 1 year ago now, I started going to a gym, and I was so proud of myself. I could do 20 steps on the stair machine. And that was a big ask, and I could not believe that people would spend half an hour on that thing. Like, no way. So you have different levels of fitness, and when you go to the gym, if all you can do is 20 steps, that is great. And if you expect yourself to do 200 or 2,000, that's just mean. So there are different levels, and we've got to be kind of honest about that. Well, because I was going to go to Ladakh and climb the mountain and I did not want to die, I ended up being able to do 1,000 steps.
Awesome.
Yeah. And so now I do 600 steps, but I'm just doing them faster.
Is that on those?
Yep. So the way that I do it, though, is I just imagine that I'm in the monastery and I'm climbing the steps and I'm following my guru. And I'm going, wait, wait. And it works really nicely because, you know, they say when the guru calls you, run. You don't go, oh, hang on a second. I'm just going to have a cup of tea. You run. So I'm like, run, Vivi. It's a great way to do it. And so, yes, there are, I think, when we're trying to train our mind, it's actually easier than training our body. It's easier than training for the Olympics. So the other thing that I noticed with going to the gym, that if you haven't had much sleep, it's really hard work.
Yeah.
I can only, like, do 400 steps. Like, what's wrong with me? And I can't lift the things. And this was a real shock because when I haven't had enough sleep, I can push through with my mind, no problem. I just go into another gear and it's no sweat at all. And I'm like, what? You can't do this with your body. It needs all sorts of things. So with our mind, because our mind has no form, no age, no color, no shape, no physicality, actually, there are no limits there. It's what constrains us is this conventional form. Nevertheless, when the Olympics are on and everyone puts in all that effort, to get a gold medal or whatever, I mean, the kind of training that you do for the Olympics, if you did the same amount of training for Buddhahood over the same amount of time, you'd get there. So there's a traditional 3 year, 3 month, 3 day retreat, which is actually less than training for the 4 years for in between Olympics, isn't it? And it's the same thing. You have a complete program, total immersion, lots of support. So imagine if we did that instead. Okay, so here's a little bit more from Open Heart, Clear Mind, Thupten Chodron. The Buddha advised us to be very practical and to the point without just getting distracted by useless speculation. He gave the example of a man wounded by a poison arrow. If, before consenting to have the arrow removed, the man insisted on knowing the name and the occupation of the person who shot it, or the brand of the arrow, or the site where it was manufactured and what type of bow was used, he would die before learning the answers. The crucial thing for him is to treat the present wound and prevent further complications. Similarly, while we're entangled in the cycle of our physical and mental problems, if we get sidetracked by useless intellectual speculation about irrelevant subjects that we can't possibly answer now, we're foolish. It's far, far wiser to get on with what's important. So this is where we take the teachings as a personal instruction. So we have the Buddha as the doctor. If we think of the Buddha not just as a historical figure, but a doctor, someone who can actually help us, who understood the illness, who cured themselves. So over on this side, we have the Tanka there, the painting. Blue Buddha. So that's the aspect of Buddha as medicine Buddha, the great physician. Diagnose the illness, all the causes of the illness, prescribes the cure. Not under the sway of drug companies, no ulterior motives, not just a fad, not just an influencer, not just some made-up theory for uni because it's got a nice acronym. Evidence-based. Then we have the actual refuge, the Dharma. The Dharma is the medicine. So this is where we have a prescription from the doctor. We get the prescription. What do we do with that prescription? Do we collect all of our prescriptions? Come upstairs and see my collection of prescriptions? Do we frame them? Do we feel proud how many we have? We have to take them, isn't it? We've got to use them. So that means we've got to internalize the teachings every day, take them on board into our daily life. And it also means that we've got to follow the instructions. Because what happens when you get your box of antibiotics? What if you took them all in one day because you're like, I can't be bothered. Let's just get it over and done with. I'll take them all now. So it's got to be measured out bit by bit, and the cure will happen. So this means that if we have, even if we have a beautiful altar, we have a statue of the Buddha, we try and be good, if we don't actually try and internalize the teachings by practicing patience, by watching our speech and our actions, we're not being a Buddhist, just having an altar isn't being a Buddhist. It's kind of just like collecting the prescriptions or making a nice altar. If that doesn't actually then make our mind nicer, there's no point. I have found that because we're in quite an educated society, an academic approach can be a real trap. So there was one time here where a professor was coming for a while. And she asked me, she took, picked up one of the Lam Rim books and she said, oh, I've read that. Do you have anything less, not as simple, not as simplistic? And she really meant it. It's like she read it. She's like, yep, fair enough. I'm bored. Give me something more meaty to get my mind into. And completely missed the fact that this is something to be practiced.
Yeah.
And so intellectually, it wasn't enough for her. But intellectually, that doesn't stop you being miserable. And she was incredibly miserable, and she was estranged from all of her children. And because she was so smart, it hadn't occurred to her that being smart wasn't enough, that just knowing it or understanding it isn't enough. We have to live it. It's got to be applied Buddhism. And I have found once you start trying to apply it, it's like, please give me something more simple because this is really hard. And then the sangha, the nurses, the day-to-day help. And this is where it's really important that the teachings are a huge amount of wealth, but especially when we're in trouble, we don't know where to start, do we? We don't know, we can't even be kind to ourselves or to others. So we need someone to help us and say, just do this, just start here. And then this is the next bit, and then this is the next bit. Or to know, oh yeah, this method doesn't work for you, this one does. So our lamas like Geshe Sherab that just recently came, and Geshe Zopa that comes, and Geshe Sultram, they're like that. They can break it down into little bite-sized chunks, into the daily kind of medicine for us. If you've ever been ill and you live by yourself, it's really hard to be the sick person and the one who looks after the sick person at the same time. We need help, and part of it is being able to ask for help and to know who to ask. Part of this also then is to recognize that meeting the Dharma, meeting the Buddha's teachings, it's a really precious opportunity. And in our world that is filled with distractions, it's like getting a life-saving raft, a life raft, in amongst all the garbage. And it's really hard to distinguish all the garbage, all the, what do they call it now, AI slop. All the distractions coming at us all the time to actually recognize this is the life raft, this is worth hanging on to. Or for medicine, instead of all the sugar pills and the lollies and the cream buns and everything, the medicine may not look that snazzy, but it's medicine. So it's really up to us to recognize the preciousness of this and then to preserve the Dharma. How? By living it. Because it's a rare thing. It's really rare to have a cure or a method. Let's do another reflection. Okay, so again, as you settle your posture, feel your breath ease, as though you're entering a quiet health spa, ready to help you heal. And let your body relax, your mind relax into stillness. Set your intention that your practice today will support the well-being of yourself and everyone you encounter. And consider that the Buddha is like a wise surgeon who understands the deep illness of disturbing emotions. And remember that when choosing a surgeon, we seek proven skill, not just shared tastes or personalities. And what unfolds when we ignore our emotional pain rather than seeking proper treatment? We often find the condition quietly worsening, much like an untreated wound beneath a bandage, like postponing a necessary operation until the complications grow harder to manage. How do we identify guidance that is genuinely reliable for our healing? What do we seek out? Hopefully, we seek out steadiness and experience, just as we trust a surgeon whose results speak for themselves. Feels like entering a hospital where countless patients have already recovered under capable care. Recognizing the inner illness becomes the first step in any effective treatment. So, what shifts when we welcome support from others committed to similar healing? We feel steadier, as though attentive nurses are helping us through each stage of recovery. So let this understanding encourage you to continue the treatment of practice with clarity and confidence, moving toward a healthier, freer mind. And then may we too be able to heal and continue this great tradition of care, just as the Buddha did, guiding countless others towards recovery. Okay, so now some handy hints for the beginner and how to not corrupt our practice, avoiding the three faults. And actually, I wanted to read this thing from Venerable Gyatso about faith. You know, because we're talking about last week, what we put our trust in, what we take refuge in, how we develop our faith, and how in Buddhism, faith is actually better termed confidence, because it's not about blind belief. So he says, every day we actually invest a little faith in the objects around us. When we board a plane, we have faith that it will not crash. When we deposit money in the bank, we have faith that we can withdraw it again. Ordinary objects such as planes and banks, however, can never be completely trusted to protect us from disaster. And don't we know it now? I haven't heard the saying very much recently, but in the olden days when I was younger, there was the saying, safe as houses. No one says that anymore, do they? Not even houses to be had. So the essential quality of the three objects of faith in Buddhism is that they are completely trustworthy protectors and guides to the cessation of all disasters, including the suffering of sickness, old age, death, and terrible states of rebirth. The three jewels of refuge are reliable because they explain the root causes of suffering, ignorance and karma, and give us the method by which we can oppose and eliminate these causes. So I just thought that was an interesting take, isn't it? That what are we actually, what our default refuge or faith is not reliable at all. And yet it's just habit, isn't it? So how to avoid the three faults are being an upside down vessel, a dirty vessel, and a cracked vessel. And this is where we can go wrong as beginners, rookie mistakes. And if we can deal with these, it means that we will retain the Buddha's wisdom. It will be able to use it. So the upside down vessel, how to avoid being this. This is kind of, I mean, on the most obvious level is when you come to class and then you fall asleep. Best intentions, but it just didn't work out. And some afternoon classes, especially after lunch, they're really like, my cup is tipping. But more so than this is like being closed-minded, like being so that the wisdom can pour over you and nothing goes in. If we have a know-it-all attitude, or if we're reluctantly here, sometimes when the school kids come, there's a couple that are interested and there's a few that just don't want to be here. So it doesn't matter. Nothing reaches them. The biggest one is academic arrogance, that one of just thinking, we whiteys in the West know everything, have the best worldview, it's obvious. And so then there's no way to even begin to question. So the remembering that we're sick, we're under the sway of the disturbing emotions, that kind of humility helps us become more open-minded, open-hearted. So this one in a way is easier to deal with, and one easy thing is to just start thinking of all the things that we don't know or understand. And then instead of feeling that therefore I'm a bad person or a loser, to just relax. It's actually much more relaxing being a beginner that doesn't know about stuff to start with. Then we can enjoy learning. Taking a sincere approach, we can be honest, we can be curious. So that's one of the things, isn't it? It might have been beaten out of us at school to be curious, to ask questions means that you're stupid because you don't know. Like I don't know if it's the Queensland education system, but the fear that we have to ask questions or be curious, it's really deep-seated. More tricky though, the dirty vessel. So this is where we bring our emotional baggage with us to the teachings. And we do it largely without knowing. We might have a fear of, I think last week someone said of a fear of organized religion, a distrust of organized religion. And yeah, you look at the history of organized religion, it's pretty nasty. You can have be completely triggered by seeing a priest. I mean, that happens to have one of the lamas walk in for most of us, it's just like this wonderful pool of kindness and calm. And for other people, it's being triggered because they've been mistreated by priests as a child. So this is re really real difficulties. And what this means is we've got to sort out the so that we're not just living being triggered. Sort out this emotional baggage gently, slowly. There are other ways that we can contaminate the teachings with worldly concerns. I mean, we come here because we're looking for friends, we're lonely, we want to be with like-minded people. That's all good, sincere reasons. Occasionally, someone will come here because they want to pick up girls. Luck with that. And one time I had one guy come, he came for about two or three classes. He sat it back and he was really attentive, really intense, totally focused. I'm like, yeah, he's really into this. Okay. And then afterwards he said, oh, I make videos and I could make you this video for YouTube and you'd make lots of money. And all you have to do is give me $500 and I'll do the whole thing for you. And I'm like, oh my God. He didn't listen to any the whole time that he was sitting there, super attentive. He was thinking about framing shots. Oh no, totally missed it. Then there's cultural assumptions that we have, which are inherited, largely inherited, and we only recognize we have them when we when we bump up against it, we're trying to fit Buddhism to make to see the correlation between our society or between Christianity, where it's the same. Sometimes it's the same and sometimes it's not. One of the really big ones is, for instance, when we talk about attachment or desire, the definition of attachment in, say, attachment therapy is different from the definition of attachment, craving, desire, is different from an attachment in an email. It's the same word, and we all assume we know what we're talking about, but no. So we've really got to get to the basics and understand the definitions of things, what we're talking about. Where this can we can get caught out is, for instance, meditating on compassion. And I remember one lady saying with the Four Immeasurables, you know, may all sentient beings have happiness that causes happiness, be free of suffering that causes of suffering. She said, I meditate on compassion and it's just made me so miserable. I'm not doing it anymore. And I think it might have been Venerable Robina, and she asked her, so what do you do when you meditate on compassion? And she said, well, I think about all the suffering that everyone's undergoing. And yes, and she said, that's it. I just think of all the suffering and I feel terrible for everybody. And so that is not compassion. That's empathy. That is not compassion. And this blew my mind because I'm like, what? And she said, no, compassion is an activity. Compassion is a wish. May you be free of suffering. And it's this responsibility to do something about it so you're galvanized into action. So you need empathy to start it, but empathy alone, if we just stop with empathy, of course, we're just going to, and this is what happens when we watch the news, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's just overwhelming. We can't bear it, and then we shut off. Mm-hmm. So thinking that that's compassion, that's the big mistake. It's we've got nowhere to go with our empathy. We don't know how to use our empathy. We just get crushed mm-hmm. by the extent of suffering. So that in a way is like having this dirty cup. We've got this emotional baggage and all these assumptions that we don't know that we have, and so we get caught out. And then we think, well, I don't like meditations on compassion because they're so awful. Another one is, for instance, when we first hear about karma. And I found this, even though I was brought up a Buddhist, but I was brought up in Australia. So it's kind of like a foot in both camps. And then you think, Australia's fairly atheist agnostic, but actually it's got quite a strong Christian culture. And I only got an inkling of this kind of from left field, where you hear about karma and you go, oh yeah, cause and effect, that all makes sense. But then you talk about, you see in the news, innocent victims or terrible things happening to children, and you think that's not fair. So when you have the words, that's not fair, in your mind, that's cultural baggage, because that idea of not fair is nothing to do with karma, but we put the two together. So it's the dirty cup, and we don't even know we're doing it until we catch it in our speech patterns. So it's really good to catch yourself thinking that's not fair, because that's exactly where to start looking and to clear it out. Because underneath the that's not fair is this idea that somebody is organizing or judging. And so that takes us to an external creator, a creator God. So you might think you're an atheist or an agnostic, but actually how we emotionally function is like that, as if we believe in a creator God and we don't even know we're doing it. So then we hear the teachings on karma and we go, that's not fair. And we miss the freedom that we can have by understanding karma. So karma is more like cause and effect. Cause and effect isn't punishment or reward. It's just cause and effect. Punishment and reward and cause and effect don't fit together. There is no correlation there. And yet culturally there's a correlation, you know, that's trying to be made. And so then we get we get guilty and we get righteous and we get upset. So the start of it is to recognize that we've contaminated our thinking and to try and clean it out. Bring light to it. Part of how we do this is by getting really good at definitions. So we've got a whole class on karma, but karma, internal cause and effect. Oh, that's another one. Have you ever said, oh, it was meant to happen?
Yes.
That it was meant to happen. Again, it's a cultural thing from believing in God, an external creator, an external principle that somebody else has decided or it was meant to. And in there is this kind of built-in fatalism. But actually, karma is not fatalistic at all. Karma gives you power to change things. And every now and again, I'll read, especially in scientific papers and things, talking about consciousness or memory or the mind or whatever, and there'll be a sentence that'll say something like, well, we all know that mind comes from brain, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, hang on a second. We all know. Nobody knows. Nobody's proved it. Mind comes from brain is impossible. And yet, it's that sentence permeates our culture, it's everywhere in there. And it's because we have a largely scientific materialist culture. So it's kind of better just to recognize it and then start unpicking it. And I find the easiest way is the slips of tongue, these little sayings that we can go, ha-ha, red flag. Now, what is happening there? And there's kind of faith in that, a misplaced faith that science, which is necessarily based in physical things, physical form, can teach us about the mind, which is experience, and nothing physical about it at all. So there's a blind faith there. It's like it's not even in the scope of science. Oh, and then the cracked vessel. So the cracked vessel is where the teachings go in one ear and out the other.
Oh, I've got to watch that.
Oh, me too. I've got to watch that too. So I noticed this happens. Like Geshe Saltram was here on Sunday. Did anyone come to that? Yeah. So was it good?
I was a bit overwhelmed.
It was a lot, yeah.
Such a novice, a lot.
Overwhelmed because of the range of the questions, or yeah, couldn't
Therefore,
understand
I
the
had
questions.
no
Yeah.
sense of
Yeah.
responsibility.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, so that's right. I've probably there's a lot because there's the accent of the translator, there's the kind of time delay, and until because you have the question, then you have it translated or whatever. So there's a lag. So in that time, we've got to be active with our mind.
Yeah.
Thinking about the question, questioning the question, getting all prepared. So it's got to be active listening. And we're not very good at this active listening. We don't get much practice at it. And so then the answer comes back. And the traditional way that a Tibetan answer comes back is kind of in three stages. And it sounds like it's three times said the same thing, but
Yeah.
it's a different nuance each time. And so you've got to understand what is the new thing in this. That is saying each time. So part of that is the translator's fairly new at translating, so doesn't quite
Is he?
know to bring the nuance to the fore.
Yeah.
That's right, offer him a glass of water through
Yeah.
Zoom. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So that's also a nervous tick that translators have to have this
Right.
cough. And a
Yeah.
lot of it comes from having TB in the past. Because TB
Oh,
was
true.
quite,
Right.
yeah. So, I mean, what often happens, there's the teachings, but can we remember what they talked about? Can we remember even one of those questions or even one of those answers? So this happens to me, I get really embarrassed. People go, oh, how was Geshe-la's teachings? Oh, it was great. What did he talk about?
Yeah.
Total blank. So this is because we don't review, we don't become familiar with the teachings so that they become part of our internal conversation, part of our background in our mind. And those teachings are, they're a new way, they're a method of how to go through life. So it's all new and it's something we haven't practiced. So of course, then when things go wrong in our life, how are we going to access that? We're going to forget that we have the wealth of the Buddha's teachings there to help us. It's not going to be the first thing that comes to mind. So that's the main problem, that even though it seems a bit boring to review things and to kind of immerse yourself in it all the time so you become familiar, review, actually study as the then become really familiar, reading, questioning, talking about it. Somehow we've got to get it deep into our mind so that in the field, when things go wrong, it's the first thing that we draw on.
Yeah.
Usually when things go wrong, we just forget everything and revert back to our old habits, our afflictions. We just be reactive, knee-jerk. Yeah. And the only way to change that is exposure. And that's why having like a class like this where we have exposure to the Dharma, to a beautiful environment, to like-minded human beings, it goes a little bit towards retaining the, creating the conditions. So what we can do, number one, handy hints. Make sure to enjoy your study. You might think that's a no-brainer, but actually, because we're so academic-minded, people very quickly become uptight about study or memorizing or and forget to enjoy the journey. Just like we enjoy a movie. We don't go, I've got to listen to this movie. I've got to listen to my favorite song. Got to study. It's like, oh, I can't wait to dive into that book. And even if you're a bit tired, then just like splosh on through, just read randomly. It's okay, whatever it takes. If you find yourself not enjoying the journey, it's not because there's something wrong with the Dharma. It means that we've forgotten how precious it is. How lucky we are. We've lost that really good feeling. So it also might mean that we're tired and we've started to have expectations of ourselves where pride has crept in. So we're beginning to corrupt our purpose. So all of that, when you start feeling yourself get uptight or you start becoming impatient with other people, that's the other red flag. So people might ask a question, you go, oh, what a stupid question. That's a red flag that you've lost the joy. Because even if it is a stupid question, the way the lamas answer is fantastic, isn't it? They're always happy. They're always happy to talk about the most basic things again and again and again because of that real joy in the teachings. Everyone's on totally different points. That's right. Yeah, I know in particular Lama Zorinpoche because he went straight to the most difficult topics and everything is not just our intellect but all of our afflictive emotions know that they're on their last legs here, that their whole existence is in peril and so they come up as just delirium and sleep.
So
even that you can enjoy the whole, you know, the... Yeah, pooches, that's right. It's too overwhelming.
Yeah.
It's an overwhelm where you shut down.
Yeah.
Yeah. And especially new things like that when we get overwhelmed. Yeah. So that leads us to the next one. Don't try and understand everything all at once. The Buddha's teachings are about from here to enlightenment, to becoming a Buddha. Don't try and understand it in one night. That's ridiculous. They're really in depth. And so you can hear the same things again and again, and that comes at you differently because you're in a different place, so you hear it differently. So again, it's like take the pressure off yourself. Maybe because we've been to other courses or uni or wherever, where actually not that much information is imparted. So this is what I found. This is why I dropped out of uni, because I went to uni and I started taking notes word for word like I do with the lamas. And then I started realizing they're just talking rubbish. This is filler words. There's no information in here at all. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, I was brought up thinking that in the 70s that universities were hotbeds of radicalism and la la la, and ended up at Queensland Uni. I'm like, oh no. So there is a lot there, and trying to understand it actually is a bit of a red herring, because it's not about understanding, it's about what can I apply. And so I approach all of the classes as like a really good SBS movie. It's in subtitle, it's in a language you're not familiar with.
Country you don't know.
Country you don't know what's going on, some weird indie director, but it's really interesting, and eventually in the end, if you just sit with it, it becomes clear and something happens. You have an experience and you may not even know what it is, and it's fine. We don't worry about it when it's an SBS movie. So the teachings are like that. You sit there, you let it wash over you, you have that parallel conversation that's going on in your mind with the parallel questions, you know, that are coming up. They're part of it. And then you listen out for when they converge and you get that gold nugget and you go, that's the thing that I had to hear. That's the one that I'm taking home with me. Practicing slogans, one-liners, use your words. You might think this is a bit silly, but in the heat of the moment when everything's going wrong, that's all you've got to hang on to is just one sentence. That's all that your mind can bring up is one sentence. Like, remember, nobody wants to suffer. Remember, we are all sick.
Everything will be all right.
Everything can be all right. They can't help it. No one acts badly out of happiness. It's only out of suffering. All of these things, they're one-liners, and they're like life rafts that we hold onto in the heat of the moment so we don't complicate things and make things worse. So a lot of the prayers are like that for that very reason, just one-liners, words. First, that's what we hold on to. Then they start becoming part of our practice and our experience. Apply the teachings to your own situation before telling other people. But also, rather than just as something interesting, about how would I apply that in my life? That's the question to ask again and again. How would that change what I do day to day, how I think, how I respond? And the whole Socratic questioning and follow-up. We're not very good at using reasoning and logic. Even when I went to uni for all of 3 months, no one could figure out how to use reasoning and logic in their tutorials. Nothing. I couldn't believe it. It was just like we just think about something for a bit and then we skip to what I want it to be. But to be able to do an analysis and follow it through and use reasoning, cause and effect, logic, it takes concentration and a discipline in our mind that I find really hard. So actually, the easy way to do it is to write it down. Write down your question, then question the question. And the act of trying to capture it in words, you'll feel like steam's coming out your ears. It takes a huge amount of effort, but it's a way of disciplining our mind to stick with logic. Or see, when we've written it all down, we think it's all great, and then we look at it later and go, There's a big gap there and we can see it. So I find writing it down much easier than sitting there trying to do it in meditation, because when we fall off with the contemplation, we don't know as beginners. In the end, that's what we do. That's what meditation is being able to go through the whole process, the new algorithms in our mind. But that means that we have to be able to concentrate. We have to have the fitness of concentration to be able to do that. So kind of writing it down makes it easy. So the last thing that I haven't put up as a point, but really Dharma should change us. It's not that it's something that we add to our life and then when our life gets a bit hard, we drop it again. It's like we take on the Dharma and we change as people. We change as human beings. So in the end, we've got like this lens to look through the world, a new lens, a new way to focus on the world. It changes everything, how we feel, how we interact, how we think, how we experience. And the whole thing is that we're actually getting better. We're getting the cure. I've got one more reflection and then we'll finish. Okay. So as we settle our posture, imagine your mind softening like a cup, slowly turning upright. And let your breath steady you as if washing a cup clean. And with an altruistic intention, our main reflection is this: learning only transforms us when we're open and honest and willing to practice. When we're not, teachings slip away and old habits quietly return. So thinking of the three cups, the upside down, the dirty cup, the cracked cup, each showing how we sometimes block or cloud or lose what can nourish us. So what is one attitude that keeps you upside down? Notice the answer, like a cup slowly tilting to receive water. And what old belief makes the cup feel dirty? Let the answer arise gently, as if revealed by clear water settling. And what habit causes the cup to leak? See the answer with kindness, recognizing a pattern you're ready to mend. Learning becomes less about filling a vessel and more about gradually shaping one that can actually hold what matters. So choose one small action you'll carry into the week to strengthen your learning. Okay, so We've again covered a huge amount. Benefits of recognizing that we're sick. It's the beginning of feeling better. We can become our own therapist, just like the Buddha. Recognizing that the Dharma is medicine to actually be internalized, and remember to ask for help. Don't just hide away, ask for help. The Four Noble Truths are a way of describing what our afflictions are and showing the cure, and having a real understanding and confidence that a cure is possible. It's been done before. Countless people have practiced this and experienced the results. And while we may not be fully cured straight away, it's just like when you start taking that course of antibiotics and you feel the relief, like the inflammation just goes down. Like you're not better yet, but and have a beautiful, clean, clear cup. Try and become aware of the baggage. How to do that? Kindly, gently, checking up. We'll dedicate in a moment, but during the week then, the homework, question your hopes and fears, start investigating them, and see if there's assumptions and what those assumptions are that underlie them. And coming up then is, in one class, how to meditate. What meditation's actually for, why meditate? Certainly not just for a corporate reason. It's not just about corporate mindfulness. Again, some handy hints for beginners and the different types of meditation. Because also it's not just about sitting emptying your mind as if that was possible. There's different types of meditation for different results. So for our dedication, we can think we've covered a lot. You can rejoice about your efforts, appreciate them, and then dedicate the efforts that it's to alleviate misery, obvious suffering, to alleviate all of the confusion that makes us run towards suffering, to actually cure the very causes of suffering. So we remove all the afflictive emotions to reveal our natural purity, attain our own liberation, and then lead all other sentient beings out of suffering, because it's possible.